to raise the salience of the issue at a time when the intersection between science and technology, with national security, public policy, and our media landscape is going to be one of the defining features of U.S. governance. I strongly believe that the path forward for sound guardrails for AI is going to be industry specific. It's going to look different in education than it does in healthcare, than it does in financial services, as it should. When I think about the ability to do AI, I think of it as a nexus of three major assets. One is data. You literally need the training material. Second is compute, right? Which to a certain extent is really becoming a question of energy. And then the third is talent, really is the ability to construct the algorithms necessary to advance these LLMs. Ultimately, the United States is not going to win by trying to play keep away from China. We're going to win by running faster than China. And we're going to win by recognizing that the 21st century is going to be a competition between two operating systems.
Welcome to the Regulating AI Podcast. Join host Sanjay Puri as he explores the dynamic and developing world of artificial intelligence governance. Each episode features deep dives with global leaders at the forefront of regulating AI responsibly, tackling the challenges using AI can bring about head-on and enabling balance without hindering innovation.
Welcome to Regulating AI, the podcast where we explore the intersection of policy, innovation, and responsible AI development. I'm your host, Sanjay Puri, and today we have a fascinating guest who made history by being the first U.S. congressman to deliver a speech written by artificial intelligence on the U.S. House floor. Please welcome Congressman Jake Auchincloss from Massachusetts 4th District. Congressman, your background spans military service, local government, business, and now national politics. And you've taken a bold step in demonstrating AI's capabilities right in Congress. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on. Looking forward to the conversation.
Wonderful. Congressman, we have a global audience. Obviously, U.S. lawmakers, staff, policymakers, entrepreneurs, and then in Europe as well as in Asia, and some in Latin America too. So let's start with your historical ChatGPT written speech. What motivated you to use AI for a congressional address, Congressman?
To raise the salience of the issue at a time when the intersection between science and technology, with national security, public policy, and our media landscape is going to be one of the defining features of U.S. governance.
So, Jake, the whole perspective was that let's really bring this to attention, especially for your colleagues, right, in terms of what it can do so that people do understand that.
For my colleagues, yes, but actually more so for industry leaders. I strongly believe that the path forward for sound guardrails for AI is going to be industry specific. It's going to look different in education than it does in healthcare, than it does in financial services, as it should. And the best way to adopt sound policy for AI, as I think is the case for any new technology, is for subject matter experts within industry to engage and to volley back and forth problems, ideas, and solutions, and then to organically come up with the guardrails that they want to see in place, and then to interface with public policymakers about those. That's a much better way than top-down, one-size-fits-all diktats from Washington.
Well, I think you made some great points. So if I can just follow up on a couple of those points. Jake, EU passed its EU AI Act, which is a fairly comprehensive bill that goes across. It's a risk-based system. What you're proposing is a more industry or vertical specific situation. Why do you think that would be better, again, for our listeners, than the something comprehensive across the board?
I strongly disagree with how the European Union is approaching AI, and indeed with a lot of technology. The EU seems to be aspiring to be the regulator in chief of the world, and yet has become a desert of innovation for much of this technology. And if it's not careful, it's going to be totally left in the dust on coming up with the groundbreaking science and technology that defines the 21st century. I do not think the United States should be following in the EU's template. What I believe is that we should have an outcomes-based rather than a technology-based regulatory regime. So what do I mean by that? What I mean is that instead of regulating AI or regulating SQL or R or C++ or any other technology, we should define crisply and clearly in a tech agnostic manner, what are the outcomes that we think are acceptable and what are the outcomes that we don't think are acceptable. So I'll give you two examples to make this real, both in healthcare. If a biotech company is using AI to look in higher dimensional space about protein folding possibilities to come up with new targets for drugs, that's great. I hope they do that. I hope they do more of it. And the FDA isn't going to ask, well, you know, what were the GPUs that you were using on this program? They're going to say, is it safe in phase one? Is it effective in phase two? Is it safe and effective in phase three? It's an outcomes-based approach. Similarly, within Medicare under CMS, if United Health Group is using AI to proactively deny prior authorization requests for needed care, that's a tort. That's not acceptable. A health insurance company can't proactively deny requests without clinical basis. Whether they're using AI or they're using, you know, a customer service hotline, to me as a policymaker, it's unacceptable either way, and the technology is secondary to the outcome.
No, so that's a great input. You made several comments. We have a lot of listeners from Europe. What you're saying is Europe could end up being the desert of innovation. I need to remember that line. That's a pretty cool line. But just coming back to this, I've spoken to a lot of your colleagues on this show. They say we already have a lot of laws in place. FDA does a lot of AI approvals. We have FAA and other things. So is your perspective, we just need some additional laws for areas that are not being covered, you know, whether it's the FTC or things of that nature? Jake, what would you suggest?
I'm in no rush to pass any type of general AI law at the federal level. In fact, I'm not even really sure what that would look like. That doesn't mean that we don't need any new laws in general, though, and I'm happy to give a couple of specific examples. So
please.
First, there is a bill that would basically create a public cloud for access by universities, by small companies, by nonprofits, by civil society, in order to tap into the compute necessary to build large language models. I think that's a public good that the federal government should be providing. We do not want these corporate walled gardens where only OpenAI or Facebook or Google can do the kind of high-powered compute that is necessary to train new LLMs. And having a public infrastructure that people can hook into for a modest fee, I think, is a public good that's likely to expedite innovation. So we should do that. And that's small dollars given the potential ROI. The other thing that we need to do is amend Section 230. This is the 1996 law that immunizes social media platforms for any liability regarding third-party content posted on their platforms. And in 1996, that law made sense. It was a good idea. It's been called the 26 words that gave birth to the internet because it shielded online entrepreneurs from bad faith lawsuits. The world has changed, okay? It's mission accomplished, the internet was born. But now 30 years later, these major internet platforms have become the wealthiest, most powerful corporations in history, and they are attention fracking our kids. They're making them miserable by exploiting their attention spans to sell their eyeballs to the highest bidding advertiser. Mm-hmm. We need to crack down. We need to say, hey, it's not acceptable if you are platforming cyber harassment, bullying, intimate privacy violations, defamation, libel, things that are already torts, you actually have to have skin in the game. Now, these corporations will come back and they'll cry foul about the First Amendment, and it's nonsense. We have the First Amendment. It's doing great. Mm-hmm. TV broadcasters and radio journalists and print journalists have wide latitude to criticize anybody they want, me included, with no issues of retribution. These social media platforms are not trying to defend the First Amendment. They're trying to defend their narrowly vested exception to the law under Section 230. And I don't understand why they should get special treatment that journalists the world over don't get.
Yeah. So basically what you're saying is there are two areas. One is democratizing access, which is what you're saying, you know, small dollars. And second is section, this 230 repeal of that. And there's a bill in the Senate, as you know, that talks about it. You touched on something also, which is fairly important. Our social media is kind of dominated, Jake, by 5-6 companies. The message that goes to the children, our town halls. And right now we are in the danger of the same thing happening in AI, you know, because it costs a lot of money, those foundation models, etc. What can Congress do? I mean, to make sure. Now, obviously, there's this whole issue of open source, closed source, etc. But what is there a role for you or U.S. Congress to make sure we are not in this? Because if you thought social media was bad, AI is going to be, 10 times as much. So what can U.S. Congress do towards that?
It's a superb question. I would not claim a monopoly on the answer. So first, I think the tighter controls around Section 230, and you'd mentioned legislation. I have led bipartisan legislation in the House, along with Ashley Hinson of Iowa, called the Intimate Privacy Protection Act. And that curbs Section 230 protections unless these platforms can demonstrate that they are taking, that they have a due process to prevent, in particular, deepfake pornography being targeted against young women on their platforms. And this is an example of where we need a new law based on AI, because obviously it's always been theoretically possible to create graphic content without somebody's consent. But because of AI, because of these nudification apps, it's now at a scale that creates really a difference of principle as opposed to just a new area on the continuum. And I'm worried this is going to ruin kids' lives. We're going to see a situation where the lives of young women, and actually young men too, are going to be ruined by this. Mm-hmm. These social media platforms don't care. They just legally don't have to care, and they need to. They need to be responsible. So one, we've got to put those bounds in place. Number two is, when I think about the ability to do AI, I think of it as a nexus of three major assets. One is data. You literally need the training material. Second is compute, right? Which to a certain extent is really becoming a question of energy. And then the third is talent, really is the ability to construct the algorithms necessary to advance these LLMs. And while Amazon and Meta and Google and Facebook all have different products and markets and use cases, at the strategic level, to me, they've all kind of started to merge towards the same thing, which is that the three of them are all just warehouses of those three things. They're all warehouses of data, compute, and talent. And so the way that I think we democratize the ability to innovate with AI is to think about how we democratize across those three asset classes: data, compute, and talent. Mm-hmm. The public cloud is one element of that with the compute. Mm-hmm. Data through the open source effort, I think, is the other. And then the algorithmic development, I actually think that's going to happen organically, because we're seeing that the algorithms and the ability to evolve these LLMs is becoming further and further commoditized.
Mm-hmm. So that's an excellent point, that there are three aspects of it. And, with data, open source, with compute, giving shared access, and then talent, obviously. Google just announced, I think a couple of days ago, that 25% of their programming or coding is now being done by AI.
And Sanjay, what we have to watch out for is this acqui-hire phenomenon meant to skirt antitrust laws. Because if you think about in this day and age, in something as intangible as an AI startup, 25 people, just by virtue of like all connecting on LinkedIn and deciding that they're going to announce a company together, probably right off the bat have a $100 million valuation, right? Like, no exaggeration. If it's the right 25 people, heck, if it's the right five people, and they just decide that they're going to come up with a name together and announce a new venture, right off the bat, probably a $100 million valuation. And I'm not throwing shade on them. Good for them. If they have that kind of market value based on their talent and what they've done previously, rock on. What I do have a problem with, though, is if one of the big companies then acqui-hires them to prevent any type of competition, and functionally just hires people through an acquisition and skirts, or I should say acquires it through hiring, to be clear, and skirts FTC purview because of it. That, I think, is something that we have to watch out for, because it's how the big guys are going to gobble up everybody else.
So I presume you're talking about, there's three specific examples with Inflection, the acquisition, well, acqui-hire, because the CEO moved over, the employees got left behind, and the Microsoft paid off. And then you character AI with Google, and then you had with Amazon. What role, is this FTC's purview? They're looking at it, etc. Because obviously they've found, these companies seem to have found something, because now every one of them is doing it. Yeah. Is there a loophole or something that they're looking at?
I don't want to comment on specific instances because
I'm just saying general acquihires, just general acquihires.
But this is firmly within the remit of DOJ and FTC. They are going to have to go, I think, what is incumbent upon the federal government in this area, though, is clear and predictable and consistent rules of the road. Rule by law or regulation by enforcement is not acceptable. It's going to chill investment and create uncertainty for entrepreneurs. We want to be the AI hub of the world. We want people starting new ideas, and we want them getting acquired, by the way, because those liquidity events then create a cascade for the next entrepreneur. So I love it. I want all of it. But I am very skeptical, though, of the big companies trying to protect their moats by stamping out anybody else building a castle.
Good points. Jake, if we can just shift a little bit to national security, you've got a tremendous background in there. You also sit on the Select Committee on China. So a couple of things in there, because that's become, you know, AI, to be very frank with you, Jake, has become a national security issue. It's become a geopolitical issue. Tell our listeners, how does your experience on the Select Committee for Strategic Competition with China inform your views on AI regulation?
I agree that it's a national security issue. There's so many areas that we can dig into here. Let me pick a few out and be specific about them. So one is energy. As most of our listeners, I think, will understand better than I do, a lot of AI functionally is, at this point, an energy play, right? We're seeing nuclear power getting bootstrapped by AI companies, and that's terrific. What I think the United States needs to do is build on the ADVANCE Act. So we passed the ADVANCE Act this Congress, one of the rare bright spots of an otherwise relatively dysfunctional congressional term. What the ADVANCE Act does is it makes the Nuclear Regulatory Commission have to not just think about the safety of nuclear, which of course is vital, but also how to promote nuclear power in America. It also creates regulatory certainty and responsiveness for fusion as well as fission power. This is really exciting because we have now created a regulatory regime whereby fission and fusion could potentially scale up dramatically in the United States as a share of our utility grid. We're too low. We should aim to build 1,000 nuclear fission or fusion power plants over the next decade or two. The Chinese are doing it, and they're not just doing it for themselves, they're exporting it. And when you pair nuclear power with, you know, desalination plants or data centers, what you do is you become the vital linchpin resource for everything else a developed society wants to do. That's a tremendous amount of leverage that we should not be yielding to our pacing adversary. So the United States needs to become a clean energy powerhouse. I think fusion and fission are the keystone of that aspiration. And we have to get so good at building these modular plants, the way Gates is trying to do out in Wyoming, that we can not just do it at scale domestically, but export the capabilities overseas. That's a tall order. I have utmost confidence in our ability to do it, though, if we get public-private alignment. And there's some things that we can do with Department of Energy to accelerate that. Number two is we have got to put a demand signal into the marketplace for embedding AI in robotics. This is, to me, the near-term critical element. Unmanned aerial and unmanned maritime systems need to be able to swarm, sense, surveil, and strike with the synergy of hardware, software, and artificial intelligence. And we are at the very, very beginning of that journey. The best way to expedite that journey is for the Department of Defense to slap several billion dollars on the table and say, you build it, we buy it. And they have grudgingly gotten there with the replicator program, which is for drones. But we're at this point, and I've said this directly to DOD, that replicator program is a PowerPoint slide. They have not put money behind it. They need to get serious about buying these things. And then we got to test it in the feedback loop of real war in Ukraine. And then get ready to deploy the maritime systems paired with the aerial systems in the Indo-Pacific. The Indo-Pacific is very different than Afghanistan and Iraq, where the U.S. military over the last two decades has learned how to fight. This place is full of water, it's big, and it's going to need a lot of dispersed, decentralized, autonomous systems that are, again, able to both operate individually, but then also flock together, swarm, surveil, strike, and then disperse again. That's going to be how we beat the Chinese out in the Indo-Pacific.
So you pointed two things for our listeners. One is obviously energy is critical. And you said fusion and probably micro nuclear opportunities. That would be one. And the second thing you talked about is robotics and unmanned systems being very, very critical. And robotics is really coming of age. I'm sure you know this, Jake, where the confluence of AI and robotics is really, really changing. Now, obviously, the issue is the Chinese have also made some tremendous advances in robotics, and it's not just us thinking of that. So on the select committee, Jake, we've obviously put down several restrictions on export of certain categories of chips to, you know, China and certain other countries. What are your thoughts? I mean, do you think this is going to kind of, let's say, our adversaries hold them back? Or what else can be done for us to keep us ahead of the curve here?
Ultimately, the United States is not going to win by trying to play keep away from China. We're going to win by running faster than China. And we're going to win by recognizing that the 21st century is going to be a competition between two operating systems, the US operating system and the CCP operating system. And operating systems like Android and iPhone are about who wants to build on top of that hardware. Meaning, who wants to build on top of US military security guarantees and freedom of navigation guarantees and our diplomacy and our soft power and our culture and our economic exchange versus who wants to build on top of the Belt and Road and the CCP's use of its naval bases and forces in the South China Sea and elsewhere. And right now, we are in a fierce competition in the global South between the operating systems. There is too much emphasis in Congress about the way that we win is by trying to mildly degrade the CCP operating system by preventing chip exports or impairing telecom exports or impairing outbound investment. And you know what? In isolated specific examples, maybe that's the wise thing to do. I supported the president's October 23, for example, semiconductor export controls. But we are kidding ourselves if we think that's how we win. The Chinese have 1.4 billion people. Most of their students are scoring higher in math and science than our students are. We think that we're going to win in a science and technology race in the 21st century merely by some isolated export controls? Absolutely not. Let's get serious here. The way we win is by creating a world-class science and education enterprise, and through robust and mutually beneficial terms of trade with the global South and with our allies. We should have joined the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Because you know who's now leading the biggest trade partnership in Asia Pacific? China. We're not at the table. We're on the menu for them. We should be re-upping AGOA, our economic partnership with Africa, as it comes up for reauthorization in Congress, and figuring out how we can deepen those trade ties and development ties and investment ties there. Because the Chinese come to Africa and they build power plants and train stations. We got to be out there providing real tangible economic value as well, and access to our markets is part of that. So we will win by doing what America does best, free enterprise, trade, and a rules-based international order. We should not try to win by aping the CCP's myopic, mercantilistic approach.
So continue out-innovating, continue working with the global South is what you're saying, and bring people into our value system, I think is what you're saying.
And it's good for the US economy. There has been a lot of claims that somehow trade is bad for the US economy. It just doesn't stack up in the economic numbers. Now, if we are trading with people who are cheating, and the Chinese have been cheating under WTO rules, then yes, that's not acceptable. We need to level the playing field, and I support legislation to level the playing field against China for environmental or labor or IP or country of origin malfeasance that is undermining the terms of trade. But in general, trade makes both parties better off, and it gives our entrepreneurs bigger markets, and it makes us invest more, and it also makes us more productive and efficient. And I think we've got to double down on that core strength, recognizing that we have to prepare Americans to succeed in this economy. And there's myriad ways to do that beyond, I think, what was an overly limited approach in the 90s and early 2000s.
No, those are very important points. Jake, we obviously have an election coming up in a few days, and then you're going to have a new Congress. You said you're against, obviously, comprehensive legislation, but you're focused on some industry sector, whether it's deep fakes or things like that. What is your feeling in the new Congress? Do you think we're going to have some, whether industry specific or issue specific, whether it's deepfakes, et cetera, kind of legislation moving forward?
For AI?
Yeah, for AI.
I worry that Congress will do the knee-jerk thing, which is to stack export controls on top of one another and make it seem like we're hurting China, when in fact what we're doing is empowering Huawei and other Chinese companies, SMIC, to own those domestic markets by themselves and thereby to get the kind of production and economic scales that they need to go down the production cost curve and embed their own influence and metrology into those new industries, which is a major source of US soft power. So I would be cautious of those. And like I said, specific isolated examples where we think we have outsized leverage, okay, I'm on board. And again, the president's export control order, I thought, did that. I think it's worth noting that the reason the president had the leverage in that export control order was because of ASML, a Dutch company that builds lithography machines and has probably the most globalized supply chain of any product in the history of mankind. And so it's ironic to me that we are taking a protectionist stance by leveraging the power of one of the most globalized companies in the history of the world and the success story of global supply chains. The reason we have the leverage of ASML is because of terms of trade and free exchange. And we have to recognize that we win by our network position, not by a zero-sum approach to exchange. What I think we could also do, the deepfake issue we discussed, that's bipartisan. I've launched that bill, and we're going to attempt to kickstart and galvanize support for it in this next Congress and gain co-sponsors from both parties, particularly focus on parents of kids in Congress. I'm the youngest parent in the Democratic caucus, and I don't want my kids growing up in a world of just toxicity and trash. I don't want them to learn about America through algorithms that amplify the worst amongst us. I want them to learn about America through the ideas that represent the best of us. And these platforms are part of the problem right now.
Those are very important points. Jake, AI is moving very, very rapidly. As you know, when ChatGPT came out, we've had now multimodal, we have agents, etc. How does Congress or regulation keep pace, or how do you have regular updates to AI regulation? I mean, that's the one question I get from your colleagues a lot. How do we keep up to date? Because things will change in 6 months or a year.
It's a fool's errand to try to think that we're going to regulate in pace with the development of LLMs or with even the use cases of LLMs. I mean, there's a booming industry of entrepreneurs, investors who are going to figure out how we embed agents into knowledge work, and I think we're going to see things that are hard for us to predict. Just like if you were sitting here in 1992 talking about, well, I think Web 1.0 is going to do this or that. I mean, we would have gotten it wrong. And by the way, Washington would have gotten it wrong too. What were the two kind of critical things that got us to the ability to do AI at the level it is right now? Well, one of them is GPUs, which came from video game semiconductors in the 1990s. And the other is the LLM transformer model, which came from translation services in the early 2010s. If you had told a Washington policymaker in either of those eras, hey, I think video games are strategic, or hey, I think translation services are strategic, you would have been laughed out of the room. So policymakers should not have the conceit that somehow we're going to predict where AI is going years from now, months from now. What we should do is be very clear about the torts and the standards that we expect from any private sector enterprise. I don't care if you're using blockchain or AI, or if you're using good old-fashioned SQL, or if you're handwriting it. It doesn't matter. This stuff is illegal. That stuff is not illegal. This is the outcomes that we're driving towards. And entrepreneurs can innovate within those sandboxes.
Yeah. So trying to stay legislation to update with technology progress, as you said, is a fool's errand. Jake, I have a zillion questions and I could keep going. We need to get you back again. But at the end, we have basically a very simple lightning round, one word answers. So we want to just ask you a few questions on that. Are you ready?
I'm a politician, so I reserve the right to use 10 words where one word will do, but
absolutely. And you can also plead the fifth. Okay. Jake, more important for AI, innovation or safety?
I don't accept the premise of the bifurcation there.
Okay. I forgot who I'm talking to. Okay, biggest AI threat, China or big tech?
Yeah, again, I just think the world is more complicated than that. I mean, what is TikTok? Is TikTok China or big tech? I guess it's both, right? And it's a huge threat to the ideological formation of our youth and to the spread of disinformation. So it's just.
I think this one I'll be able to get an answer from you. AI regulation should be federal or state-based?
Yeah, I don't in the public policy realm, I don't deal in one word answers. Again, it's just specific cases, right? If we're talking about Section 230, that's got to be federal. If we're talking about some banking or insurance issues, that may be state, where they tend to have wider remit. If it's education, maybe it's local. Time will tell, but it's got to happen organically, and there has to be tight feedback loops with reality. It can't just be a one size fits all top down approach.
Do you think current AI regulations are they sufficient or lacking?
I think we need to update our laws for just the reality of what 2024 looks like, and deep fakes and abuses by health insurance companies and all of these things. I don't support sort of a one size fits all AI bill, though, in Washington. I don't think that would be appropriate, and I would be worried about what lawmakers would try to stuff in there.
Finally, open source AI or proprietary AI?
I bend towards open source.
Open source. Okay. Finally, Jake, based on your experience in so many areas, what's one concrete action for our listeners, whether they're AI developers, policymakers, or concerned citizens, that they can take to promote responsible AI development?
Promote local news. One of the great casualties of the last 15 years of the dominance of big tech has been the collapse of local news. And that has, I think, maybe chief amongst all of the various ailments in our democracy, caused a decline in civic and social trust. When I first ran for city council 10 years ago, we had a local newspaper. And that reporter was at city council meetings and was holding me to account and holding the mayor to account. And it's gone. It's gone now. I see a world in which AI, as opposed to being part of the problem by covering the internet with pink slime, can be part of the solution by helping to support local news and local journalists. And so I would encourage people to build in that space, recognizing how hard it is, how hard the revenue streams are to create in that space. Build there, you'll do a tremendous amount of good.
So promote and read local news. I think that's what Jake is saying. That'll really create value for our democracy, for our social fabric. So thank you, Jake, for you really sharing your insights on AI regulation and policy. You know, your unique perspective as both a tech-savvy legislator and the first to use AI-generated content in Congress really offers us valuable insights into the future of AI governance. And to our listeners, remember that shaping AI policy is a collective responsibility that requires engaged citizens like all of us. So join us next week for another episode for Regulating AI, where we continue exploring the path towards ethical and innovative AI development. Thank you so much, Jake. What an incredible session.
Take care.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to the Regulating AI Innovate Responsibly podcast. You'll find links in the show notes to any resources mentioned on the show. If you're enjoying our podcast, please subscribe so you'll never miss an episode, and leave us a 5-star review.